everyone from beautiful downtown Kabul. That's kind of what it sounds like in here anyway.
Yeah. That's...
Welcome to End Credits here on the just above the construction CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me today is...
Vince Masson.
Vince, are you enjoying that jackhammering?
Oh, I am, yes.
it gives the show an unexpected flavor.
Doesn't it? Yeah. A really aggressive tone today, unfortunately.
Well, it's, you know, maybe it'll help with the review anyway. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 2 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the spooky adaptation, Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Scary stories here in the light with all this hammering going on, I tell you what. That's in the back half of the show. For the first half, we're going to talk about some of the latest movie news from the past week, including The Rock himself, Nick Cage. He was in The Rock, you see, which is... Anyway. The actor gave a crazy freewheeling interview to the New York Times, and we'll discuss the fascinating insights. And then it's still technically summer, but we will look ahead to the movies of the fall and pick the ones we're most looking forward to and the ones we might end up checking out on the show. And then, well, first of all, I should say, the internal drama of the Disney and Fox merger still ongoing. We got a little bit more insight into what that relationship is going to look like into the future. Variety had a story about how they are, Disney actually, not Variety, is paring down the number of movies that Fox currently has in development. They're pretty much going to be sticking to, it sounds like, franchises. So Avatar, which is obviously under, I was going to say under construction, but I think this is just the background noise that's getting to me. But currently in production, the Avatar sequels, they're going to, Planet of the Apes was also mentioned, although I don't think there's another Planet of the Apes movie in the works. I think War for the Planet of the Apes was kind of the last ride for that.
So basically, Fox was tanking. Disney was like, yeah, we'll take over from here.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's kind of what's driving it, is that Fox lost $170 million the third quarter of this year.
And what were those? Just a combined bunch of movies that lost that? Like, it was Bad Times at the El Royale and various other things?
Well, yeah, from the sounds of it, most of it is Dark Phoenix.
Right, yes.
Dark Phoenix tanked. Although I don't remember I don't think it tanked, but it's one of those weird situations where they spent so much money on it, it would have to like make $1 billion to make a profit.
Right.
So it's, yeah, I mean, and there are other things too, like there's like advanced marketing costs for movies that are coming out and like, you know, stuff that's in production. But yeah, also because like the recent slate of films like Widows was another one, Bad Times at the El Royale, these were movies that...
The Hate U Give. And...
Yeah, that, you know, were well received, I think.
Yes.
But perhaps made some money, but didn't make, you know, Avengers Endgame money, let's say.
Right.
So,
but they used like the example Love, Simon, that was made on a $17 million budget that made $66 million. Like, that seems pretty good to me. Like, that's
right.
It's not the kind of numbers that they want now, but like, it seems like that's okay for what things used to be. I don't know.
Yeah, but the question is, I think there used to be some room for movies that, you know, just did okay. But I think one of the things that is sort of affecting the bottom line is like the straight up marketing costs. It costs so much to get marketing because you have to cover so much of the media because the media itself is so dispersed. You know, you can't just buy TV ads on Thursday night. Mm-hmm. I mean, because that's the way it used to work. It's, you know, that's one of the reasons why must-see TV was so huge for NBC in the 90s was because if you have a movie coming out on Friday, where are you going to want to buy real estate where the most eyes are seen? It's everybody watching Friends and Seinfeld and Frasier on Thursday night. So you can put those ads on. But, you know, now you have TV. You have like 1,000 different channels. You have social media. You have Facebook ads and Twitter ads and YouTube ads. You have... like it's still the old stuff, like radios and newspaper ads, magazines, you know, it's a much bigger advertising world. And there's no guarantee that anything, like, you could have a great movie like Widows and still not get the attention that it deserves.
Well,
and
that's what the other article was saying, that somewhere around 2014, 2015, people stopped going to the movies as they traditionally had and started going to event movies, you know what I mean? Big spectacles, which I sort of agree with. It was like, is this movie worth seeing in the theater?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, Widows, I guess, to a lot of people was a movie that you could catch on streaming or whatever. Mm. But these spectacle movies seem to coincide with the experience that people want now at the theater. But it's all a shame. It's a serious shame. Like it is. What you're seeing is the curbing of original, like adult-driven content, or adult-oriented content, perhaps. And more money, more support behind things that have already proven to have worked in the past, right? Steven Spielberg, why are you remaking a movie that won Best Picture, that won 10 Academy Awards? Why do we need a modern-day update of that? I don't understand it. So,
You know what? It's
a shame.
I do understand to an extent when you, like, mount a new version of a musical. I mean, because it's it's sort of in the tradition of theater where you put on, I was going to say reenactments, but you're not reenacting, but you put on like new shows, new versions of shows that have been done before. And, you know, West Side Story has been done 100 different times and 100 different stages. One of the things I will point to is that the Spielberg's West Side Story, which is one of the Fox movies that has survived the purge.
Wow.
Of course, it's in production right now, too, but mm-hmm. is that it's going to be like a racially diverse cast, as it, you know, should be, with considering that one half of the cast is Latinx. So, I mean, there are reasons to remake it beyond just, you know, the fact that it's
you could
well-known IP.
You could dig into, like, any movie and say, well, here's the reason for it.
But to your point...
But not to denigrate West Side Story. What I'm saying is that Fox sees all of these movies as a failure and is now kind of tightening the noose. It's what it seems like.
Right. To your point...
Even though Fox Searchlight has won, like, 3 Best Pictures over the last, like, 6 years or something, right? It's like, these are the last, like, studio making respectable, like, art with actual integrity. You know what I mean?
Right. No, to your point, if you look at the top grossing movies of the year so far, 5 of the 6 are Disney. So you have Avengers, you have Lion King, Aladdin, Captain Marvel. I can't remember the other one. But
Aladdin?
I said Aladdin.
Oh, okay, sorry.
No, it's all right. Aladdin, Lion King, Avengers, Captain Marvel. Well, it doesn't matter. But the fifth one is actually Spider-Man, which is a Disney co-production. It was, you know, released through Sony, but a Disney co-production just the same. So it's like, you know, unfortunately, that's sort of the nature of the business. And Bob Iger, who's the head of Disney, said he's put Alan Horn and Alan Bergman in charge of establishing, quote, discipline and creative standards at Fox, which I think just basically means, like, do what Disney does, where we have a Marvel movie, we have a Pixar movie, Toy Story 4, that was the other one. We have like another animated movie. We have our Star Wars movie. We have a remake, and then that's kind of like your calendar year,
right?
So you know that's kind of what the Fox form is going to be. I will, however, say that, you know, at least Fox Searchlight is standing for now. They have Jojo Rabbit, the Taika Waititi movie coming out, and Lucy in the Sky, which is based on the. I don't think it's based on her story, but it's sort of like inspired by that astronaut woman who drove like several days to find the man she was in love with. But it's, you're right. It's not a positive sign. I think a lot of overly optimistic people were hoping that it would be like Fox will keep doing what it does. And if Disney wants to try more adult fare, more risky fare. They'll just stuff it under the Fox, 20th Century Fox banner, and then have at it. But that has not, from what has been reported so far, that has not been, that's not the idea that's driving Disney. They're just going to basically do what Disney did at 20th Century Fox with 20th Century Fox. And then following along with that is that report that they're already looking at a remake of Home Alone, a remake of Night at the Museum, a remake of Diary of a Wimpy Kid, remake of Cheaper by the Dozen, which has already been remade. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these are going to be potential Disney products on the Disney streaming service, which is already sort of like geared to continuing the propagation of like their established brands. Like there's a Lady and the Tramp remake that's being made for Disney Plus with like Justin Theroux and Tessa Thompson as the voice of Lady and the Tramp. Disney has become sort of like a recycling recycling plant.
Well, and that's what it is. It's all about money. They don't care about making good cinema anymore. Look at how they speak. You lost $170 million. Like, it's done. We're taking control now. It's like everything is about the dollar now.
Mm.
Whatever. People can have fun flocking to these movies. I don't care anymore, honestly.
It sounds a bit like Vince cares. But speaking of being all about the money, Nicolas Cage did a fascinating interview with the New York Times that's gotten a lot of people, I guess, interested in him. Not that people weren't interested in Nicolas Cage, because he's one of these figures. You know, he's an Academy Award-winning actor. He's done a lot of great work. He's been a box office star. He's done some inferior work. But, I mean, he's like sort of the definition of a movie star. And what they've pointed out in this article is that he's done like 20 movies in the last few years because he's just like taking work because he's got this like back tax debt.
Instead of filing for bankruptcy, which some stars do, he just decided to like kind of buckle down and pay it off himself.
Right. But I mean, like, it's stuff you never would have heard of. And I went to IMDb and it's like, what are all these movies? And some of them you might recognize, like Mandy, which was like a critically acclaimed movie that a lot of critics got behind. He's like, but like some of the movies like you have heard of, like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Teen Titans Go to the Movies, where he's like only the voice actor. But a lot of this is like straight to video dreck, like Bangkok Dangerous level stuff. It's not like the Nicolas Cage, we used to rave about. It's just...
No.
It's like Escape Plan 2 starring Stallone and Dave Bautista that's like direct to Netflix. It's crazy. It's like, that's not the fate we wanted for Nicolas Cage.
No, but he was never an actor that was like about the realistic kind of like digging deep into characters and like accurately portraying them. It was always like this kind of surreal, over the top kind of thing as well.
Yeah.
Which I think is also what that interview was trying to explore. Like, what is it about that kind of style that you like?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it definitely goes into like, it's like the pretty deep theory of his craft.
Right.
If we can call it that. What I kind of took away from it, and it's interesting that Johnny Depp came up in conversation, because him and Nick Cage have kind of like parallel problems. They're not the same, but they're definitely like they have problems with money. And if you haven't been following, like Johnny Depp is like in court with like his managers and a couple other people who manage his money over the fact that he basically been accused of like being a spendthrift. Like he takes all these like big budget blockbustery movies, like the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and the Harry Potter, the Fantastic Beasts movies, because it's a big paycheck for him because he has so much money going out the door. And it's interesting that him and Nicolas Cage talked about how they were playing Monopoly one night and Johnny Depp wanted to get into music, but Nick Cage was like, no, you should go into acting, and referred him to his manager. And they, oddly enough, have seemed up on similar course where like they're both like kind of taking work because they're trying to deal with money problems and rather their inability to handle money.
Well, the manager, like, got him into Nightmare on Elm Street, which was his film debut, Johnny Depp.
Yeah.
And Nick Cage was like, overnight successes don't happen often in this business, but he is one of them.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it is interesting. I don't know. Like, but you have to kind of talk about, I feel like Nicolas Cage has kind of entered into the realm of great actors. You know what I mean? It's like, how often do we talk about Nicolas Cage when we talk about great actors? But the truth is, I think even despite all of those kind of stinkers that we were talking about, he's just kind of remained... I think also what he was trying to do was get away from the big budget kind of studio stuff and get back to kind of the more independent stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Get back to the Bad Lieutenants and the Mandys and stuff like that as well.
Which is so good. Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Yeah, yeah.
It's insane in all the good ways.
You can only imagine what Werner Herzog and Nicolas Cage working together must have been like.
Werner, I'm going to go into this box and I'm going to like think about my character for a minute. And then then you count to 10 and knock on the door and I'll come out and Brian will scream. And
Werner is like, Nicolas Cage is very intense.
Nicolas, I like where you're going with this. but then he's also done stuff in the last couple of years, like the Left Behind remake.
Right.
Which I actually watched because I thought like Nicolas Cage in like Christian apocalypse movie this is like subliminal, right? It's like a gateway drug into, but no, it was like he played it straight, which was so disappointing. Yeah, it just, I kind of feel bad for him because he is this character. In the interview, he almost feels like the Bela Lugosi character from Ed Wood. I realize Bela Lugosi was a real person, but you know, it's someone who's kind of like lived in his own legend for maybe too long.
Right, yeah.
And so he's kind of like become the persona and the thing that people kind of see him as.
He definitely got like huge into like philosophy, like deep philosophy kind of stuff. Right. Definitely like got down that kind of rabbit hole. He even said like it got too much at one point, like I just couldn't like have a normal conversation with people.
You couldn't have a normal conversation with this reporter.
Yeah.
I did find it interesting that, you know, he hated Our Town,
right?
Which is like sort of like the acting, like sort of one of the acting you know, sort of guideposts. It's like when you've acted in Our Town, that's like that in Hamlet, and there's certain things that like as an actor you want to do, and Our Town is one of those, but he hates Our Town.
Right.
I don't know. It's weird. Like Nicolas Cage.
Well said.
We're going to take a quick break here and play some music without some jackhammers. And then we're going to come back with the movies we're most looking forward to in the fall. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU. A clip from the trailer for It Chapter 2. It comes out on September the 6th. I think by any objective measure, probably one of the most anticipated movies of the fall.
Oh, yeah. The first one was so entertaining.
Yeah, I like the first one, too.
Is it the same director?
Yeah, Andy Muschietti.
Okay, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's... I'm not a big Stephen King guy, so, but, you know, I enjoyed it surprisingly. But anyway, we will be taking a couple of weeks off, and It Chapter 2 will be our first review back when we come back on September 11th, and Peter will be here for that one. He doesn't like scary movies, but he was perfectly okay volunteering to review It, but...
See, that's why you need to pull a prank on him when he comes in the studio. You need to be wearing a clown costume, or there need to be red balloons around here or something.
Oh, my goodness. Can you imagine? Like, just leave red balloons. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about, instead of planning Peter's coronary, let's talk about other movies we're looking forward to. You go first. What's a movie you're looking forward to this fall?
It Part 2. No, seriously. Number five, It Part 2. I have rewatched the first one like many times, and I find it very, very entertaining. I'm not sure if we need, like, you know, such an epic tome or whatever you would call it. But hey, I'm looking forward to it. I thoroughly enjoyed the kind of adult part of the miniseries, the Tim Curry miniseries as well. Mm-hmm. People said that was like the weaker part, which I agree with, but there was still some entertaining stuff. As long as they don't do the whatever it was, stop motion.
Right.
Or very terrible CG spider.
I think it was stop motion. It was pre-CG a bit.
Right, right.
James McAvoy does not have a long, luxurious ponytail, which is what the guy who, I can't remember his name. I know he was on The Waltons, but like he played Bill Devereaux in the miniseries. And like, whenever I see that ponytail, I'm just like, yeah, somebody get me the scissors.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. But fair enough. So,
yeah. So yeah, no good. It Chapter 2 is a good one. I do have a sequel for my first pick.
Right.
And it is legit because it does come out 2 days before the first day of winter. It's Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker, which is the last chapter of the Skywalker 9 trilogy or whatever you call it. But it's the last chapter of the sequel trilogy. I'm interested in it because I am interested in the trailer didn't reveal much, and it did hint at things like, are we going to find out, like, a different story about Rey's parents? Is, like, the Emperor coming back is kind of, like, strongly implied? Like, things, like, I'm kind of iffy about because I was perfectly fine with Rey's parentage as revealed in The Last Jedi. Like, I don't need characters coming. Although Lando Calrissian's coming back in this one. Billy Dee Williams is coming back. So I'm pretty okay with that.
Cool. I'm sure he'll be in a spinoff series in 2 weeks.
Maybe, but what I'm most interested in is that, like, J.J. Abrams has to answer his own mystery box, which is something J.J. Abrams has never done. Like, he's, like, created compelling mystery boxes when he's, like, created Alias, and he co-created Lost, and he co-created Fringe, and then he did Star Wars The Force Awakens. But he's never had to, like, answer his questions. He's always posing these, like, who's this person's parent? What does this clue mean? And what does this thing have to do with this other thing over here? He's never had to answer them. He does this time. And I'm very interested in seeing how he handles that. Anyway.
I'm sure good will not triumph over evil. That won't
that
happen.
That would be a twist.
Wouldn't it? Yeah. Incredible.
Okay, your next one.
Well, my next one is going to be the James Gray movie Ad Astra, which, of course,
yes,
Fox is now riding on to make big money along with Ford and Ferrari. But James Gray, like, this guy has actually an amazing track record, right? Lost City of Z was hugely underrated when that came out. That was one of my favorite movies of that particular year.
Mm-hmm.
I think he also did The Immigrant, but I'm not totally certain.
Might.
But every single one of his movies has been extremely interesting. There's no reason to suggest that this would not also be interesting. Brad Pitt, of course, coming off some producing credits and now getting back into kind of the leading man status. So I'm looking forward to it.
Coming off of Once Upon a Time, too.
Have I?
No, he has.
Oh, yes.
So, and a lot of people really like him in that movie. So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Were you one?
Yeah, I liked him a lot in it. I thought he was good. Yeah. Yeah, that made my runner-up actually at Astra because I do like the trailers. The trailers are interesting. My next pick is one we've already mentioned on the show, Jojo Rabbit, which is Taika Waititi's next movie. People will know him probably best for Thor Ragnarok, but he's also done like really excellent comedies, like really bizarre off-the-wall comedies like What We Do in the Shadows and Hunt for the Wilder People. Like, talk about underrated. Mm-hmm. I think both are available on Netflix and both are like seriously worth like just sitting down and watching and laughing at. They're phenomenal movies. This is it's being advertised as the anti-hate satire because it's about a boy who's a German boy living with his single mother during World War II. And of course, he's grown up in Hitler's Germany and is of course enamored with Hitler's Germany, but his preconceived notions of what that means end up hitting a wall when he discovers that his mother is hiding a Jewish girl. Mm-hmm. Now, this doesn't sound like material for a great comedy, but I haven't mentioned the fact that Taika Waititi appears in the movie as the boy's imaginary friend and idiotic version of Hitler.
Right.
Which may not still be sounding like a selling point, but I mean, it's...
And he said he did no, like, research or preparation for it.
It's not exactly Downfall.
No, exactly.
But it's
which like, is like, yeah, you know what I mean? It might be funny how he does it. I don't know.
Yeah. But it'll be interesting to see what the reception to this is.
Right.
It's probably his biggest move outside of like anything connected to Marvel or even like probably even bigger than Flight of the Conchords. It'll be interesting to see what the reaction of this is. Anyway, your next one, number three, whatever.
Well, my next one is going to be Ford versus Ferrari.
Oh, yeah.
That does come out in the fall, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right, true.
I think November, yeah.
Yes, so both Big Fox gambles on my list, actually.
You got your fingers crossed for Fox.
Yeah. But there's no reason to believe this won't be like a really good movie, right? You got Christian Bale and Matt Damon.
Yeah.
I forget who is directing this picture. Who is directing Ford versus Ferrari again?
I will look it up. Keep talking.
But no, this is obviously kind of award season kind of material.
Oh, James Mangold.
James Mangold. Okay, so fantastic director of Logan, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Doing a true story. Okay.
Yeah. It's interesting. I like car race movies. I don't like car racing because this made me think of Rush.
Right. But it actually kind of reminded me of The Aviator in some ways. I don't really care about aviation, but they made the movie so compelling that and kind of weaved aviation into it so well that it was very good.
Yeah. No, I'm looking forward to that too. My next one is one I've talked about a lot on the show, so I won't go too much into it. It's Knives Out, the Rian Johnson whodunit, which seems like a kind of Agatha Christie kind of clue, kind of joint. And it looks like it harkens back to his humble beginnings as the director of Brick and of especially Brothers Bloom, because Brothers Bloom has a comedic element to it, which this also seems to have.
Right.
Also great cast, Daniel Craig, Chris Evans, Toni Collette, Jamie Lee Curtis, mm-hmm. Christopher Plummer, Lakeith Stanfield, Catherine Langford, Ana de Armas. So it's like, if this thing sucks, I'm going to be really, really upset.
Right.
Not that I think it will suck, but I mean, if like...
Just prepare for it to suck, because that sometimes happens with big movies.
It does sometimes happen, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So my number two is a movie that's also like already been mentioned. It's mm-hmm. Jojo Rabbit.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But I am really pulling for Fox Searchlight, okay? It's like, who else banks on material like this except Fox Searchlight, except maybe A24 at this point? But even then, it's like they do some very heavy kind of drama movies, I feel.
Yeah.
Although not really with like Eighth Grade or Booksmart, sorry.
Well, I think like Booksmart though is like their most marketable movie they've ever done.
Right, but like, Fox Searchlight, I'm always like, come on.
Yeah,
I'm rooting for them.
Yeah,
and I think this looks interesting.
Yeah.
I have to give him credit for having the guts to do a movie like this, actually.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's interesting, too, because I remember an interview with Matt Groening. He did, and somebody asked him, like, what's a joke that, like, on The Simpsons that, like, you didn't like? And he said, like, any joke about Hitler.
Right.
And it's like, I get that. You don't want to joke about Hitler. But I think when you don't joke about Hitler, I think humor is humanity.
Yeah.
And I think when you don't joke about somebody, even somebody as monstrous as Hitler, what you're saying is that he was basically unhuman. He was like a monster, which means he's kind of like apart from the rest of us. Like, we can't learn the lesson of Hitler that basically anyone, like, if you push them the right way, can be Hitler.
Correct, yeah.
So I hope that's one of the messages that comes out of Jojo Rabbit. Not that I'm right. trying to, you know, tell Taika Waititi what to do, but...
And one of my favorite movies, or one of my favorite comedies of all time, Four Lions.
Mm.
A kind of similar material, right? Got mm-hmm. swept under the rug because it was kind of dealing with material that was perhaps a little too relevant at the time, but mm-hmm. these kind of stooge-esque guys in London, England are trying to start their own kind of whatever terrorist organization.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they're just so dumb that they keep fumbling everything. And that's what it did. It kind of like took the seriousness, the majesticness or whatever of these practices and just kind of, you know.
Yeah.
Threw shade at them.
Yeah, and I think we really need that shade. Speaking of sort of timely, my next pick is Queen and Slim. It's the first feature-length film from Melina Matsoukas, and it's written by Lena Waithe.
I thought that was the alternate title for The Favorite.
Queen and Slim. No, this is definitely not The Favorite. It stars Daniel Kaluuya and a new actress named Jodie Turner-Smith. Well, I'm not sure how new she is, but I mean, she's definitely a new face sort of in the cinema. Mm-hmm. But it's basically, it's like a romantic sort of drama. It's almost like a bit like True Romance. At least this is how it seems like from the trailer. It's like True Romance meets If Beale Street Could Talk, where it's this black couple.
I don't even know where to begin to
I know, but
try and picture that.
It's this black couple. They're out on a date. They're driving home, and Daniel Kaluuya is the boyfriend. He pulls over, and a policeman stops him, and a fight breaks out. It's like she, you know, the officer is basically... every nightmare about, you know, white police officers and black people sort of like being acted out, except the police officer is accidentally shot by Daniel Kaluuya. And so they go on the run, fearing like reprisals from the cops. And it's about like they're like being tossed into this like exceptional circumstances. And there's romance, there's danger, there's drama, there's like a timely message about what it's like being racialized in America. I don't know where to begin, but I'm definitely looking forward to seeing where it goes.
Awesome. Who directed that?
That was Melina Matsoukas.
Okay.
She's done some TV and some music videos,
right.
But this is her first big
and,
movie.
And I'm always down with whatever Daniel Kaluuya does.
Absolutely.
He is one of the great new stars, I think, of
Absolutely.
Hollywood.
Absolutely. That brings us to your number one.
Yes. Well, my number one has remained pretty much consistent for the entire year, and it's going to be Todd Phillips' Joker
movie. Yes.
I can't explain why the images and the trailers and all of this stuff have haunted me kind of as much as it has, but it really has. And you know what I mean? Like, I don't think anybody expected Adam McKay to come out with The Big Short and do something as amazing as that. So there's no reason to think that Todd Phillips, I think, mm-hmm. can't have something as acclaimed after his kind of, you know, slapstick kind of earlier career.
Yeah, he's certainly capable. I mean, if you've seen War Dogs, he's, like, been bending that way.
Right.
And, I mean, this is opening – I don't know if it's opening Venice, but it's, like, in competition in Venice.
Yeah, it's a part of the TIFF lineup as well.
So, I mean, somebody's betting big on it.
Right.
So it's worth
paying attention. And Joaquin Phoenix, of course, one of the great stars of of today.
I'm very
enamored by the fact that they're not kind of tying it into this whole superhero universe. They're kind of doing a more grounded contemporary story, I guess. This guy is a failed kind of stand-up comedian type thing. People are comparing it to Martin Scorsese's King of Comedy, which is one of my favorite movies of all time. So I'm speaking of movies that I will be mad if they suck, this is one of them.
Mine is a little bit different. Like, I didn't want to go. I felt Joker is a little bit obvious, and we're definitely going to see it. But one of the ones I've sort of become interested in is this one, Hustlers, which is also at TIFF, based on a true story about strippers who turned to crime after the 2008 financial crisis. So they end up like ripping off these Wall Street guys who ended up ripping off America. So also feels kind of timely. It's got a really interesting like female-led cast. So you have Constance Wu, Jennifer Lopez, Cardi B, Kiki Palmer, Julia Stiles, Lily Reinhart, who people know from Riverdale. She plays Betty. And Mercedes Rule, who really needs to come back. I'm glad she's coming back. So,
if I knew who that was, I would be in agreement with you.
She won an Oscar. I can't remember which movie. I think it was. No, I don't want to say. I don't want to sound like an idiot. But she's like this really great actress who.
Yeah, don't mess with me on Oscar history, my friend.
who I think like is one of these like for because she's a woman of a certain age, and so she gets like sort of aged out of movies. But I'm glad that she's.
This is a true story, is it?
It's based on a true story. Yeah.
True. Okay. All right.
So, those are some movies that we may or may not be reviewing, but definitely movies we're going to be trying and watching in the fall. Coming up next, we will talk about a movie we recently watched, and it is also scary. Well,
according to some.
You're listening to
How's
End
that
Credits.
For foreshadowing?
Yeah. You're listening to End Credits here on CFRU, 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio.
You want to see a haunted house?
Some kids went missing, so they boarded it up.
Okay, we saw it. Should we go now?
Who ordered the chicken?
What's that?
It's a book of scary stories. Tell me a story. Hey, what's going on?
Tommy's missing.
Tommy's name was in the book. There's no way it's actually connected, right? Okay, what if what happens in the book is exactly what's happened for real? Oh my God. Augie!
Stella!
Listen, you're in the next story.
We're reading it right here.
It's a corpse looking for her missing toe.
You can only imagine what happens next, but that was a clip from the trailer for Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. It's a new film from Andre Overdahl, and it stars Zoe Coletti, Michael Garza, Gabriel Rush, Austin Zajer, Gil Bellows, and Dean Norris. Sadly, probably the biggest waste of Dean Norris since Under the Dome.
Yeah, he showed up. Did his two phone calls and then went home.
I hope he enjoys the new addition to his house.
Yeah.
Yep. I was assuming. We don't know for sure. But yeah,
this kind of sucked.
No, I don't think it sucked. I don't think we were the audience for it.
Yeah.
I do think there's something to recommend it if, because this is based on
the Alvin Schwartz books.
Right. Which I think,
right, which I grew up with. It's like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like, I read those when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. But it's like horror for a certain age.
Yeah.
Like, if you are you know, too young for Freddy Krueger, too old for Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, or even like the Goosebumps books. Like, this is sort of like the bridge from one era of horror to another era of horror.
Yeah, and that's the problem for me, is that I just know these stories too well, and quite frankly, just don't think they were very well adapted. But you also have to take it in the context of the story, which is kind of a straightforward narrative, right?
Right.
Like, kids kind of stumble upon this house, and there's this book, and there's this legend, whatever, and it's a very kind of standard, you know,
yeah,
arc from there. Right. Nobody believes them. The cop in town doesn't believe them until it happens to him, of course. And then everyone is crying wolf. And right. So I agree. I can't.
Vince
I can't
is underselling it.
Sorry about that. But like, I just have to review it like based on my own kind of personal interpretation. And
yeah.
Wasn't that scary? I'm sorry.
Yeah, it does. It takes the Goosebumps approach, and meaning that, you know, in the 2015 Goosebumps movie, it doesn't adapt any one particular Goosebumps book, but it's like an independent story about a fictionalized version of R.L. Stine, and his stories end up coming to life. And it's kind of similar here, where it's a lot of the scary stories that people will remember from the books, as the books are anthologies where it's basically a series of short stories. But they are brought together in this connecting narrative of this quartet of young people who find a book of scary stories that adds a new chapter. And it seems that it's targeting these kids who not stumble, but they go to check out a haunted house on Halloween.
Yeah. The problem is, a lot of these Alvin Schwartz stories, like, were not based in logic or reason or reality, right? It's like the case of the big toe or whatever. The guy's gardening and then he finds a toe in the garden. It's like, it's not meant to be logical or represent logic in any way. But this movie is trying to ground them in logic. It's like, now he finds the toe in the stew and he's like, bro, there's a toe in the stew. Oh, man. And he's reacting as if like a contemporary teenager would act. But it's like, it doesn't work for the kind of material that it's coming from, right?
Right.
It's like, I understand, okay, the scarecrow coming to life, that was more of a traditional kind of thing. But a lot of the other ones just, like, don't really work. And there's, like, there's stuff like when he's being chased in the hospital, and it's like 15 minutes of this guy, like, going down this corridor. Oh, no, the monster's there. He goes down another corridor. The monster's there. And it's like, they kind of do this nice sense of, like, dread. It's closing in on you.
Yeah.
But then the payoff, like, is so kind of weak, I feel.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, I thought the monsters, like, just were not that, like, scary looking.
Glad,
like,
you said that, because I found the monsters weak. The monsters were the weakest part.
The
of this,
one
is,
with like the toe looked like something out of The Walking Dead. It was like, looked like just your run of the mill zombie.
And it's weird because it's like the monsters are like one of the things. Guillermo del Toro is one of the producers, and I think he co-wrote the script.
Right.
So this is kind of like his wheelhouse. He's big into the monsters, and like had a hand in designing like the monsters, went from like Shape of Water to like the Hellboy monsters and Pan's Labyrinth and the monsters there. So he's got a very good eye for like creature design. And I feel like these were like cast off creatures that he wanted to use in those other movies, but then cut them for whatever reason, and they kind of end up as leftovers here. And it, like, I hate that because the creatures themselves are boring. On top of that too, part of the plot is like the book kind of reads you and knows what you're afraid of and uses that against you. And then
it writes the stories that you are familiar with.
But it, like, some of it's like very, very like weak. Like the one boy who's attacked by the scarecrow, that makes sense because we see him early in the film like abusing the scarecrow just because it's there.
Yeah.
But the one you mentioned about the kid who finds the toe in the stew, it's like he was scared of becoming a cannibal. Like,
yeah,
what's that about? but you know, but sometimes it works. Like one of the monsters later on is this monster who falls down the chimney in pieces.
Oh no, man! And then, that did not work.
It worked because thematically, because it goes after Ramon, who we find out is a draft dodger, because his own brother came back from Vietnam in pieces. Like it's not a subtle metaphor, but it's definitely thematic. I don't know.
That's a bit of a stretch. I think. And then there's like just this absurd car chase with that thing. It's like, what is this? I don't remember this from the Alvin Schwartz books, this high chase car scene.
The car chase was a little off. But I mean, there's stuff in this, like, it's never explained.
And then the last, like, yeah. I don't want to give it away, but the ending when she finally confronts the ghost who has been writing like all of these stories felt like a 20-minute episode of Dr. Phil. She was like dishing out some like therapy. She's like, you know, I understand your family like abused you, but, and it's like, okay, is this?
That would have been something out of like the Casper live action movie. Or, yeah. It would have been like have Dr. Phil come out now, Sarah Bellows.
You need to stop writing stories and haunting people.
These kids did not haunt you.
Our impressions are just on point today.
They're not bad. They're not bad. If we do say so ourselves. But, you know, there's a lot of interesting stuff. By that point, the thing coming down the chimney,
right. It's like you already know what's going to happen, right? It's like...
Yeah, I don't know. There's a lot going on that I think I would have liked to have seen exploited a bit better. Like the whole thing about the town secret about how the family that founded the town was basically like kind of poisoning the town. That's
right.
Kind of loosely introduced, but it's never followed up on. It would have been interesting too, because it's inferred that the mill they ran was poisoning the local water with mercury, which tends to drive you crazy. You know, what if like she's making this because she's crazy with mercury poisoning or something?
She's writing some pretty good stories for someone on mercury poisoning.
Right. But it, you know, there's stuff like that. It's never like one of the subplots about the main girl, Stella, who I liked as kind of a character idea, this girl who's kind of like into the macabre and, you know, the weirdness. And I wish that had been exploited a bit more, but you know, it's inferred that her mother left her and her father. She thinks it's her fault. It's never really highlighted why she thinks it's her fault.
No, just so it can come to a dramatic, teary-eyed confession with the father at the end.
Yeah. And that's too bad. I feel like I'm underselling. Like, I feel like I'm talking like I hated this movie. I didn't hate it.
But
I don't have an attachment to the stories like it sounds like you have. So,
Like Mitai Doty Walker, that story, like, so disappointed.
Right, like, so I didn't bring that into it.
Right.
So I could just, like, sort of, like, lay back. Well, not lay back, but sort of sit back and just, like, let the movie happen. And I did appreciate, like, the art direction. Like, it really does feel like lived in 1968. Like, all the cars are great. I think this was shot in Ontario somewhere, because it definitely looks like Ontario, like small town Ontario.
It's just where they pack the van and go to Ontario whenever they need a creepy house now. How much better would this have been if it was like a Netflix anthology series, like Love, Death, Robots, or
or Black Mirror or something, you know what I mean? Like, each one can be set in a different time, have a different director, have a different voice, different style. Said it was all this plain Jane, like, PG-13, we can't show too much, we can't do too much, we can't offend too many people type stuff. And it's just like, these books were too iconic for you to do that. I'm sorry.
I kind of bristle when people start talking about, like, a movie would be better if it was a TV show, because I think there's, like, way too much of that. But I think there's a lot – there were a lot of ideas floating around here, and I think this is another one of the situations where if they'd done, like, another pass at the script or had, like, taken the ideas and, like, and used them in like, a new script – because I like the 1968 setting because it would be an era where a kid reading a book would be really sort of provocative. Like, because that's how you, as a kid, you would get those, like, before the internet, you would read, like, forbidden books. And I really like the scene where they're, like, doing, just because I guess I'm a research nerd, that, like, they're doing, like, old-fashioned research without, like, the benefit of a computer where they have to, like, pore over microfiche and handwritten town records. I mean, I like
that. There's always a research scene in every single, like, horror movie. We got to go to the library and hunker down and learn the history of the town and the people. And it's like...
That's one of the things
I... Come on, man. At least he skipped that in Hereditary and Midsommar. That's one thing I will say about Ari Aster. He skips the cliched, like, research scenes. He just doesn't explain it to you.
You know what? When they go to the library in Booksmart, that's one of my favorite scenes in Booksmart.
Yeah.
Because you don't normally see that in the teen party movies, the montage of going to the library to find the location of the party. But I digress.
Fair enough.
But I think that, again, we're not, being older men, we're not the target audience of this. Like, and the theater I didn't see it in was particularly full, or which is to say that was rather empty. But there were some young people there who I did think were able to tap into this, were able to see something that they were able to get into. It's a little bit forbidden, and there's some stuff in this where it's like, it's not like explicitly gory, like certain scenes in Midsommar, but it's like sort of just gory enough. It's like a tease gory, and I think there's stuff in it like that. I think if you have sort of like apprehensions of a certain manner, like there's a scene with like a boil on a girl's face that, if you've ever seen Dr. Pimple Popper on TLC, probably make you whinge a little. One of the things that made me whinge is when one of the kids is like dragged under the bed and you hear the nails in the wood floor. Right, like that, I cannot stand that sound. And I was sitting there with my like notebook clenched, and I did not enjoy that. But so I think it depends on your taste.
Yeah, I guess that's fair to say. I don't know. I find myself just like, perfectly adequate.
Whatever. All right. Perfectly adequate. That'll look good on the poster.
Exactly. If they wanted to be honest for once, they would.
Well, I look forward to when studio executives start taking your advice, Vince. That'll be an interesting day.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that'll be the day they stop making Star Wars movies.
You heard it here last. That is it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. And if you want to listen to it again, you can find us on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. Find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show or on Twitter at End Credits Radio. And Vince, where can people find you if they want to lodge a formal protest about your cancellation of future Star Wars movies?
You can contact me on Twitter and get in line with everyone else.
What's your Twitter handle?
At VMassin5.
There we go.
Sorry.
That's all right. It's summer. I will be back on...
Not midsummer. All right, we got to stop.
I will be back on CFRU tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson, or go to GuelphPolitico.ca for News and Politics there. We will be back on September 11th for our review of It Chapter 2, and in the meantime, stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will see you in September with new episodes. In the meantime, repeats Wednesdays at 2 p.m. for more end credits, and we'll see you then.